You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Fighting for the Soul of France by Tom Sancton. Irrespective of immigration issues, Islamist radicalism has struck France hard. In the past year, the country has suffered four serious attacks by terrorists, including one grisly incident in which a middle school teacher was beheaded by a man of Chechen descent for having shown caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad as part of a classroom discussion on free speech. In response, Macron proposed a so-called anti-separatism law aimed at upholding secularism and combating such extremism. The measure, wending its way through Parliament, targets online hate speech, bolsters government oversight of religious associations, and reinforces the requirement of religious neutrality in the public sphere. Though the text never mentions Islam specifically, some leftist critics complain that it discriminates against all Muslims, while some on the right say it doesn't go far enough. With an eye to a probable second-round duel against Le Pen next year, the Macronist forces are adopting an increasingly hard line on immigration, radicalism, and even dress codes. We're seeing a rightward shift being carried out on the back of Islam in the name of secularism and the Republic, says Michel Oueviorca, a prominent sociologist. I think this move to the right is a French way of resisting cultural change. Meanwhile, another incident set off alarms over now-left excesses in the universities. This March, Melanie Luce, a 24-year-old law student and president of the left-leaning National Union of French Students, revealed that the organization sponsored non-mixed meetings reserved for non-whites. That triggered critics who saw the exclusion of whites as a form of inverted racism. Comparing the practice to fascism, Education Minister Jean-Michel Blanquer vowed to take legislative action to ban such meetings. In her cramped office in Paris, Luce tells me that the nature of the meetings has been totally misunderstood. They're just twice-a-year discussion groups, she says, on sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, and Islamophobia. The aim is for people who experience discrimination to be able to express what they go through in a setting that allows them to speak freely. Luce, who is biracial herself, her mother is a black woman from Guadeloupe, her father a white Jewish man from Paris, contends, "What my generation wants is true equality, where a person who looks like me doesn't have less of a chance to succeed than a white person, where we don't have to hide when the police come." The political class has trouble understanding this aspiration. The evolution of French thinking on race has been transformative. Under France's universalist doctrines, all citizens are equal and undifferentiated, to the point where the government keeps no official statistics on the ethnicity of its own population. What's happening today, however, is that race, once considered by many to be a non-issue, has become paramount in the eyes of this new left, along with gender, LGBTQ+ rights, and the combination of discriminations that fall under the overarching heading of intersectionality. Proponents insist that the notion of race has been ignored by an establishment that has failed to come to terms with France's history as a colonial and slave trading power. True equality can only be achieved, they say, by examining and deconstructing that legacy. That is the meaning of the decolonial movement, championed by researchers like Nasir Gwenev Sulimas, a sociologist at the University of Paris 8. The question is to know how to move away from the colonial nature of power, she recently told Le Point. This colonial order has not disappeared with the end of colonial empires, but is reconfigured and continues to act. Post-colonial thought, she says, seeks to dismantle the persistence of social and political hierarchies founded on the racial categorization of humans. Many critics see these new movements as imports from U.S. campuses, where black studies, women's studies, and gender studies have long had their own departments. French resistance to such categories is not just a matter of knee-jerk anti-Americanism. It reflects a deep-seated belief that U.S.-style communitarianism is fundamentally at odds with the French model of a unitary nation of equal citizens. The Anglo-Saxon tradition has another history, and it is not ours, Macron said last fall, bemoaning the rising influence of certain social science theories imported from the United States of America. Others are more scathing. The left is becoming Americanized, says Finkelkraut, and it's an Americanization much more toxic than the Coca-Cola and blue jeans that the French traditionally denounced. Some say the claims of U.S. contagion are exaggerated. You don't have to be American to raise issues like that, says sociologist Wevorka. People in France began to pose the question of identities in the wake of the May 1968 student uprising. One thing is a constant in France. When you want to disqualify an idea, a way of thinking, or a political current, you say, oh, that's American. Indeed, the country of Simone de Beauvoir did not need American feminist to focus attention on gender discrimination. Similarly, much of the groundbreaking work on post-colonial theory was done by French and Francophone thinkers, such as the political philosopher Frantz Fanon. In fact, the current debate on decolonialism has more to do with France's own legacy as a colonial power than with sociological theories coming from across the Atlantic. Yet, certain trends do bear the undeniable mark of stateside influence. The U.S.-born hashtag MeToo movement has taken off with a vengeance in France. In recent months, the list of prominent French personalities under fire for alleged acts of rape, sexual harassment, incest, or pedophilia has continued to grow. In spring 2020, the Black Lives Matter protest over the death of George Floyd set off impassioned French marches, complete with English-language posters reading, "I can't breathe," and charges of police brutality in the case of Adama Traoré, a young French Malian man who died in police custody in 2016. Like their U.S. counterparts, French social justice activists have blocked campus appearances by ideologically objectionable speakers and forced the Sorbonne to postpone a play by Aeschylus because some of the white actors wore dark masks and makeup. France is slowly following the American road, lamented Le Monde editor Michel Guérin, which leads to galloping self-censorship by artists and programmers seeking to avoid problems. There is nothing new, of course, in the use of the American example by different factions in France. Tocqueville, himself a liberal monarchist, studied American democracy in the 1830s to learn what we should hope or fear from it. In the mid-19th century, it was the French left that exalted the image of American liberty and used it as a propaganda weapon against the authoritarian regime of Napoleon III. With the founding of the Third Republic in 1870, the left's ardor for the American model cooled, and for much of the next century, morphed into often virulent anti-Americanism. Today, we are seeing a repeat of earlier patterns. with many French progressives adopting American social theories and modes of political activism, while their opponents decry the U.S. influence. It was easier to reject whatever came from the U.S. of A. as long as Donald Trump was in the White House. But the American image as a whole is making a spectacular comeback in France. Ever since Joe Biden took over and launched his bold stimulus and infrastructure plans. In a sign of what Le Monde has called Biden mania, the new U.S. president drew an 82% approval rating in one recent French poll. That doesn't necessarily translate into an embrace of American-style social justice movements, but it may make it a bit more difficult to demonize them. More than two centuries ago, Napoleon carried his version of French values across most of Europe as the head of his Grande Armée. Today, two revolutions, two world wars, and four republics later, France is a very different nation. President Charles de Gaulle famously extolled a certain idea of France, a grand-sounding phrase, most notable for its vagueness. Today, more than ever, the question remains, what idea? Which France? In a diversifying land, the answers are multiple. She, herself, and we. as the other half to WeWork's billionaire founder, Rebecca Newman carved out her own little space as a woo-woo exec, and the company's downfall isn't stopping her. By Rachel Dodds. There's a cringy scene in Hulu's WeWork, or the making and breaking of a $47 billion unicorn, in which Rebecca Newman stands on a stage beside her husband, WeWork's founder and then CEO Adam Newman, at a company retreat called Summer Camp. Dressed in a t-shirt and fitted blazer, her long hair hanging limply over her shoulders, she tells the audience of assembled employees to close their eyes and join hands. Her voice is deep and monotone with a vestigial Long Island accent. Just think about a reality in which the energy that we're feeling right now with one another is an energy of unity, she says, an energy where I am you and you are me, and we are, and we all are we. But they were not her, and she was not them, and they were most definitely not we. The Newmans were we, having secured the trademark to the word and later charging the company $5.9 million to license it back. After a public outcry, they returned the money. She was commanding them to do as she said from the well-lit stage, and they were down in the mud, wearing special wristbands to track their mandatory attendance. Many of the employees at the retreat would soon find themselves out of a job, their stock options worthless, following the co-working giant's wild expansion and aborted IPO, while the Newmans would gently drift to earth under a gilded $1.7 billion parachute. When they started going into all these other businesses, I was like, are we doing something to change the world, or are we doing something to line the Newmans' pockets, said a longtime employee, one of the 20 people interviewed for this story, many of whom requested anonymity for fear of legal or professional retribution. Rebecca Newman, through her press representative Asher Gold, declined. What the Newmans have done has inspired a content bonanza, a hit 7-episode podcast series by Wondery, 2 high-profile investigative books, and a take on the story from just about every streaming service. In addition to the Hulu documentary, HBO Max released Generation Hustle, a series about American scammers, with an episode about the Newman's unusual leadership style entitled The Cult of WeWork. Apple TV Plus started production on We Crashed, based on the Wondery podcast, following the greed-filled rise and inevitable fall of WeWork, and the narcissist whose chaotic love made it all possible, with Academy Award-winning actors Anne Hathaway and Jared Leto playing the couple. Still to come, an adaptation of Wall Street Journal reporters Elliot Brown and Maureen Farrell's book, starring Nicholas Brown, who plays Cousin Greg on Succession via Chernin Entertainment, which has a multi-year first look deal with Netflix. But the Hulu documentary really hammers home Rebecca's executive dominance at the company, lest you think it was all her husband, and she has now found herself in the company of great American grifters. She is the latest example of a late-stage capitalist archetype, a member of the Chuyistocracy, banal rich white women leveraging their proximity to power to build their own personal brands. Like her friend Ivanka Trump, Rebecca lacks charisma on film and in person, according to people who know her, and gives off weird vibes. Which is ironic, given that she has been known to have people fired, such as a mechanic for WeWork's Gulfstream jet, within minutes of meeting them because she didn't like their energy. I got the sense that she was guiding the company through her astrological intuition, said a person who met with Rebecca for a contract role, during which they mostly discussed his birth sign to determine if he would be a good fit. Energetically speaking, he was not. Another person said that both Adam and Rebecca complimented him several times on his good energy when they first met him. He was hired. And then there's the company's legendary S-1 form, required for all businesses seeking to sell shares to the public, complete with a dedication on the first page to the energy of we, greater than any one of us, but inside all of us. New York University marketing professor and author Scott Galloway said in the Hulu documentary that the S-1 read like a novel written by someone who was shrooming. In fact, it was Rebecca, who is widely credited for the unconventional New Age language contained in the document, which also empowered her to select her husband's successor, should he become incapacitated. By now, just about everyone knows the origin story of WeWork, the co-working startup founded by two extremely tall men, Adam Neumann, a 6'5" college dropout who grew up on a kibbutz in Israel, and Miguel McKelvey, a 6'8" architect who grew up on a commune in Oregon. Inspired by the paradoxical concept of a capitalist kibbutz, they launched in 2010 with a single location in downtown New York City. Within 9 years, they grew WeWork to approximately 12,500 employees spread out over 29 countries. With more than 500,000 paying customers, ranging from independent freelancers to huge corporations, all while burning through billions in investors' money. By 2019, when Rebecca started calling herself a co-founder, an interesting pivot, according to a former employee, the company had attained an eye-popping $47 billion valuation and moved beyond renting desk and toward a grandiose vision involving elevating the world's consciousness through, among other ventures, co-living, We Live, education, We Grow, and fitness, Rise by We. Wowee. Next photo, the Neumanns in 2009, the year before they founded WeWork. Back in 2017, after naming herself CEO of WeGrow, a school with the lofty mission of unleashing every human's superpowers, Rebecca gave an interview to Fast Company in which she explained her motivations for expanding into education. Her eldest daughter's kindergarten just wasn't the right environment, she said. She wanted a place that would nurture children's spirits and souls as much as their minds, a place where they could learn about meditation and mindfulness, farming, and entrepreneurship. Launching a for-profit private school in the hyper-competitive New York City market was highly unusual, particularly for someone with no background in childhood education. Rebecca, nevertheless, succeeded in convincing wealthy parents to enroll their children in the school, which charged between $22,000 and $42,000 for tuition, depending on age, although many of the families were given discounts, and that had the effect of boosting enrollment at launch. Some experts in New York City private school admissions, whose clients pay thousands of dollars for guidance through the complicated process, said that even with its high-tech pedigree, the WeGrow school was too unproven a concept for them to recommend. I advise clients to send their children to schools with an established track record of transitioning students to good colleges, said Max Metz, partner at New York Private School Consultants. Would you put your children in the first spaceship, or would you want to test it out first? To Amanda Urey, founder of Manhattan Private School Advisors, the whole thing seemed like a vanity project started by a woman who was so privileged she didn't really have to worry about typical concerns, like positioning her kids for acceptance into top universities. Very wealthy parents are often more relaxed about where their kids get into college because they know those same kids will always be financially well off, thanks to them, she said. Indeed, Rebecca has said that she doesn't even know if her own kids will go to college. The school she ultimately created in the WeWork headquarters building in Chelsea, designed by Danish architect Bjarke Ingels and featured in Architectural Digest, would have morning meditation classes called We Practice and offer mentorship and entrepreneurship opportunities. In my book, there's no reason why children in elementary schools can't be launching their own businesses, Rebecca told Bloomberg. Students would spend one day a week at the Newman's Westchester farm cultivating vegetables and then selling their harvest to WeWork employees at farm stands they designed. One former WeWork employee described feeling an awkward sense of pressure to buy the produce during the workday, given that, after all, these were the boss's kids. Rebecca would wax poetic about her techno-utopian vision of the future, in which families could travel around the world unencumbered by the inconvenient school calendar. Never we mind the carbon footprint of such exploration, because soon they would have WeGrow systems, a plug-and-play subscription model education service that would exist everywhere WeWork existed. In 5 years, WeWork will be the new norm for education, Adam prophesied at an event in 2018. It wasn't the norm that year in at least one regard. Only 74.1% of the students at the WeGrow school were up to date on all their immunizations, compared to the state average of 96%. According to New York State Department of Health records, from the 2018 to 2019 school year, the most recent for which data are available, almost 4% of WeGrow students cited religious exemptions to vaccines that year, compared with 0% at prestigious private schools such as Horace Mann, Trinity, and Collegiate, although not dissimilar to anthroposophic institutions such as Steiner and Waldorf schools that are known for emphasizing children's spiritual development. The WeGrow school only had about 46 students that year, four of whom were the Newman's own children. On Lewis Howe's School of Greatness podcast at the end of 2018, Rebecca admitted she has some phobias around wellness and health, stemming from the death of her older brother from cancer when she was a child. On the same podcast, she tossed out pseudoscientific nonsense, such as the idea that eating sad animals will make you sad because you absorb the energy of what you eat, and that the secret to living forever is having a flexible spine. Rebecca has claimed to be a vegetarian since she was 12, but a person who worked closely with her said that for a period of time she ate red meat once a week because a doctor told her that her body needed it and said she would close her eyes while doing it. People who worked closely with Rebecca say that at her best, she is smart and driven and was influential on WeWork's branding, coming up with clever ideas like the slogan, "Do What You Love," focusing on creators and honing the company's environmentally conscious ethos through efforts like banning meat consumption in the office. Parents who sent their children to the WeGrow school said they were impressed by the team she hired, and that until the school closed at the end of the 2020 school year, it was a positive experience. Friends describe her as generous, always willing to offer the keys to one of her homes, a nurturing mother, and extremely spiritual. One friend likened Rebecca to a hungry ghost, a Buddhist metaphor that describes a person tormented by unfulfillment. One person who worked with her said it was difficult to get her to commit to any decision, no matter how small. For example, when Rebecca needed to order chairs for the WeGrow school, she insisted on seeing 30 samples of the same cushion so she could visualize what the setup would look like, as opposed to looking at a computer-generated mock-up, this person said. Rebecca would often ask WeWork construction workers to fix things in her homes. She loathed the appearance of cords and electrical outlets and had an office with no hard surfaces, requiring anybody meeting with her to sit on an oversized pink couch. While visitors awkwardly balanced their laptops on their knees, she would sprawl out on the floor on a fluffy white sheepskin rug. Two former employees recalled that the Newmans employed a minder per child back when they had only four children. As of March, they have six. It was a big and busy life, but as a former employee who worked closely with Adam and Rebecca says, they really believe they were anointed to change the world. Before Rebecca met Adam, she was on a six-year hiatus from dating, focusing on her spiritual journey, first in India, then in Los Angeles, and at the Omega Institute in upstate New York, where she got certified as a yoga instructor. Once she was back in New York City, the two were introduced by Andrew Finkelstein, a friend of Rebecca's from college who is now a Hollywood agent. Adam always liked regaling crowds with the story of how he met his wife. On their first date, she looked me straight in the eye and said, "You, my friend, are full of shit," he recalled, during a 2017 speech at Baruch College. He was both the star commencement speaker and finally a graduate 15 years after enrolling. The retelling of the anecdote in different locations is depicted four times in the Hulu documentary and twice in the HBO Max series, showing how a clever bit was tried, tested, and proven effective with audiences. He also has said that Rebecca has used her years of accumulated wisdom to teach him about the game of life. But as any player knows, game recognizes game. Rebecca has played many in her 43 years: Wall Street trainee, spiritual seeker, yogi, actor, mother, entrepreneur. She double majored in Buddhism and business at Cornell, where she rushed the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority, was known to her friends as Rebe, and dated a guy on the crew team who is now married to Jennifer Love Hewitt. Full disclosure, she was 1 year behind me at Cornell, and while we shared acquaintances, we did not know each other. Back then, her name was Rebecca Paltrow, and everybody who knew her on campus also knew she was Gwyneth Paltrow's cousin. Later, as Rebecca Keith, a stage name, she starred alongside Rosario Dawson in Awake, a short film she wrote and produced wherein a woman in the depths of the American nightmare is forced to become enlightened or die, according to the Internet Movie Database. But her most iconic, fascinating performance to date is playing Rebecca Newman in the Hulu documentary in which she and her husband declined to participate. Born in Great Neck, Long Island, and raised in Bedford, New York, the youngest of four children, Rebecca grew up ensconced and privileged. She always had an appreciation for nature, which she credits to her mother, Evelyn, whose family was in the garment and accessories business, and for hard work, which she attributes to her father, who ran a direct mail business and was later sentenced to prison for tax evasion. "He taught me how to live a meaningful life, which I am living today, a combination of having a loving marriage, raising children with high ethical and moral standards, and having a career that hopefully impacts the world in a positive way," Rebecca wrote in a letter appended to her father's sentencing memorandum in 2015. In a 2016 fashion spread for Porter magazine that described the Newmans as the $16 billion beatnik couple revolutionizing the way we live, Rebecca tried to downplay her comfortable upbringing, saying she grew up off a dirt road in like a treehouse. But Paltrow, who was also interviewed, promptly shut her down. They were well off, she said. Rebecca was integral to her husband's business from the start, though her role was mostly as a behind-the-scenes advisor, financier, and muse, what she called a strategic thought partner. At an event in 2018, she raised some eyebrows when she declared that a big part of being a woman is to help men like Adam manifest their calling in life. When the company launched, She was still trying to make it as an actor, according to early employees of WeWork. Her famous cousin loomed large in her mind. She debated about whether to continue using her birth name in the industry and met in WeWork's office with consultants to advise her about the issue, according to employees who were there at the time. She set up a Google alert for news about Paltrow, according to one of these people. Even when she was still trying to break into acting, Rebecca believed so strongly in her husband's vision that she took a big bet, financing WeWork's first location using some of the $1 million that her parents had given the couple as a wedding gift. Then, as the company expanded, she dropped acting altogether and got more involved in the business. Once it reached a $1 billion valuation, attaining that vaunted unicorn status, suddenly WeWork was enough for her. It was nothing to be embarrassed about, said a former employee. She took on the role of chief brand and impact officer, pushing aside Julie Rice, an executive who was hired in 2017 with the title of chief brand officer. By then, an internal memo had circulated around the company stating that she would henceforth be known only as Rebecca Newman, not Rebecca Paltrow Newman, or RPN. On WeWork's website, her title was updated to founder, CEO, and mom, specifying that she studied under His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Mother Nature herself. As the company's valuation soared, so did the Newman's dreams. Adam said he wanted to build a WeWork on Mars and be president of the world. He wanted to solve the problem of hunger and help orphans find families. We want to create a whole we world where everybody is unified and happy and together, Rebecca said in 2018. Since they were pushed out of the we company at the end of 2019, the Newmans have been downsizing. They've sold at least three of their six homes, a California estate, a Westchester mansion, and a Hamptons farmhouse, for a reported total of $27 million. Their six-bedroom Gramercy Park apartment has been on the market since last year for $37.5 million. They hunkered down in Tel Aviv for a few months in 2020 before returning to the Hamptons village of Amagansett, where they live adjacent to an estate owned by Gwyneth Paltrow and her mother Blythe Danner. As federal and state investigators reportedly examine the Newmans' business dealings, they are living their lives with their six children and support staff while hatching plans for their next ventures. For Adam, it's a new business that involves what happened in the world because of the pandemic, according to the New York Post. He's also been investing in various startups tied to the real estate world. In late April, he was spotted in Miami at an impromptu industry confab called Miami Tech Week, at a party held at the Venetian Islands mansion of financier Robert Zangrillo, who was pardoned by Donald Trump for his involvement in the Varsity Blues college admission scandal. It felt like I was meeting post-crucifixion Jesus, tweeted Dalian Asparov, a principal at Founders Fund, which organized the event. Tech investor Sheil Monat, who was also at the party, said he saw Adam wandering aimlessly around the house, adding that he didn't appear to be with anybody. He seemed pretty out of touch. Meanwhile, Rebecca appears to have a goal of creating another educational project out of the ashes of WeGrow, the rights to which she purchased when it closed. The new endeavor is called SOLFL, pronounced Soulful, an acronym that means Student of Life for Life. The Soulful Instagram account now boasts an attractive orange bubble font avatar and 26,000 followers and contains a link to a website featuring images of a surfer riding a wave, a bounty of fresh figs, and a form where you can be the first to know about what's happening with the project. According to a person familiar with the matter, she has taken over a building in Amagansett to school her kids, along with the children of a few other families, and has been reaching out to former WeWork employees to join the venture. Meanwhile, WeWork is finally having its IPO through a special purpose acquisition company in order to settle litigation with the founder and go public in February. The company agreed to give Adam an enhanced stock award worth $245 million. They don't think they've done anything wrong, said a former friend who thinks otherwise. They think everybody loves them. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Alice Waters. The Chez Panisse founder and author of We Are What We Eat, on family, floral indulgences, and fantasies of Europe. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Shopping at the organic farmer's market, buying whatever's in season that looks the ripest and most vibrant, and bringing it home to cook with my friends. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? The inclination to pretend I read a friend's book when maybe I didn't completely finish. What is your greatest regret? not accepting Peter Gabriel's invitation to go sailing when I was vacationing in Sardinia 10 years ago. What do you most dislike about your appearance? I've always wanted longer eyelashes. What is the trait you most deplore in others? A lack of generosity. It can take so many forms. It doesn't just have to do with money. So I'm always shocked when people can't muster any at all. What is your greatest extravagance? A bouquet of seasonal, local, organic flowers is dropped off at my doorstep by my friend and gardener almost every week. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Hunger. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Connecting food and education as a way to teach human values, which is the basis of the Edible Schoolyard Project. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Moderation. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My daughter, Fanny. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? My discomfort with being alone. When and where were you happiest? Whenever I visit the Rome Sustainable Food Project, I have the extraordinary good fortune of being put up at the Villa Aurelia. Perched up on the top of the Janiculum, it overlooks the whole of Rome, and I feel like I'm floating on a cloud. Where would you like to live? In a commune in Italy, with friends of all ages. Who are your favorite writers? I'm always thinking of Wendell Berry, Patti Smith, Jonathan Kozol, Tibor Kalman, Christopher Alexander, and Ta-Nehisi Coates. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Jefferson Smith in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Who are your heroes in real life? The farmers and farm workers who practiced regenerative organic agriculture. What are your favorite names? Fanny, Marius, Cesar, and Panisse. All of them Provençal names from the Marcel Pagnol film canon. What is your favorite occupation? Watching the Turner Classic Movies channel. What is your most treasured possession? The redwood tree in my backyard. How would you like to die? Peacefully, knowing I'll be composted in a mushroom suit. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Alice Waters. Now here's the issue's cover story, 3-2-1 Dua, with photos by Venetia Scott, styled by Lorenzo Posoco. Before she rocketed into the pop stratosphere, before she delivered a record of club catharsis to a world stuck dancing in its bedroom, before she broke the billion stream barrier, before the Grammys, Dua Lipa had to learn to believe in her own powers. Aaron Vanderhoof meets a star mid-flight. Opening photo shows Dua Lipa seated on a beige couch, sea green drapes in the background, and her clothing matches the drapes. Sea green bra top and sea green skirt. It was fall 2019, and Dua Lipa, the London-based pop singer, was having a rare moment of self-doubt. She had just scrubbed her Instagram clean, 21st century pop star code for symbolic rebirth, and was ready to release Don't Start Now, the first single from her second record, Future Nostalgia. The follow-up to her well-received, if not earth-shifting self-titled debut, this was meant to serve as an artistic coming of age, an exuberant statement aimed at pop charts that had been dominated by ballads and downcast hip-hop for a few years. The hardest work was done, and Lipa loved the song, a thumping, bittersweet dance floor anthem full of high disco rattles and flourishes that had confidence to spare. Yet that October, she couldn't shake a certain anxiety, one familiar to anyone who's ever released a creative endeavor online. I was like, oh, it's very different to what people have heard from me, Lipa said on a Zoom call from her London apartment in April. She sat on a couch under a playful wall sculpture, dressed in the immaculate loungewear she favored even before the pandemic. Between pauses to rein in her one-year-old rescue puppy, Dexter, she recalled that on the run-up to the song's Halloween debut, her apprehension only grew. She tried meditation. She tried hypnotherapy. I think I just needed something to just calm my brain down and help me kind of get rid of any anxiety, she said, and almost be able to tell myself that everything that I've learned I could do in my sleep. Talking about all of this uncertainty in mid-2021 is, of course, a little absurd. Don't Start Now would eventually go on to reach number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 and amass nearly 1.5 billion combined streams on Spotify and YouTube as of this writing. Future Nostalgia, a dance record begging to be heard in the common space of the club, would nonetheless thrive amid quarantine to score a Grammy for Best Pop Vocal Album and unleash an extraordinary run of top 40 singles. Along the way, Lipa became one of the first major pop stars to attempt an all-out promotional rollout from home. She appeared on late-night shows after doing her own hair and makeup, tearfully discussed her sadness about the moment on Instagram Live, and adapted to working via video call like the rest of us. The whole undertaking would turn Lipa from ambitious upstart to bona fide superstar. That she had a pre-pandemic lesson in uncertainty might have helped her chart the course. Her longtime manager, Ben Mawson, told me that at first the team hesitated about going forward through the global shutdown, as many other artists chose to last year, but ultimately saw it as a unique opportunity. She'd been waiting for this moment, he said. It was music that was uplifting and happy, and so we thought, maybe the world needs this. To American listeners, Lipa's success may seem to have come from nowhere, but her story is one of continent-crossing perseverance, a bit of luck, and one of those generational pop personalities who simply will not be denied. Future Nostalgia would have been an unusual record even if it hadn't arrived at the beginning of a global crisis. It takes a buffet table approach to the sonic decorations from decades worth of disco, funk, and synth pop, while also showcasing Lipa's keen ear for complex vocal melodies and her distinctively raspy and lithe voice. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.